Good morning. Welcome to hour number two of Focus 580. I'm David Inge, the host. Glad to have you with us. The producers for the program, Harriet Williamson, Martha Deal, Jason Croft, is at the controls this morning. In this hour of the program, we'll be talking about the potential of religion, either to divide people or to bring them together. Our guest for the show is Eboo Patel. He is the founder and the executive director of the Interfaith Youth Corps. This is an international nonprofit organization working to build the interfaith youth movement. It's based in Chicago. And we'll be talking about that organization and its aims, and also with Eboo Patel about his own life and his experiences growing up as an Indian American Muslim. Some of all of this you will find in his recently published book, Acts of Faith. The subtitle is The Story of an American Muslim, The Struggle for the Soul of a Generation. It's published by the Beacon Press. And in this book, he makes reference to W.E.B. Du Bois, the great African-American scholar, who said 100 years ago, the problem of the 20th century is the problem of the color line, talking about racial divisions in America. Certainly still a problem. Eboo Patel writes that he believes that the 21st century will be shaped by the question of the faith line. On one side, people who are religious totalitarians, and on the other, people who are religious pluralists. And he writes that he believes that the outcome of the question of the faith line depends on which side young people choose. And he, being someone who is very interested in promoting religious tolerance, founded this thing called the Interfaith Youth Corps. And we'll be talking about that, his heritage, his faith, his family's faith, and his involvement in positive activism, all of that in this part of the show. Just a little bit more about him. He has a doctorate in the sociology of religion from Oxford University. He's a regular panelist for the Washington Post Newsweek magazine On Faith blog. He's been featured in Islamica magazine as one of the leading young Muslim visionaries in America, and he's joining us this morning by phone. Questions, comments from listeners are welcome, too. We just ask people to be brief, so that we can keep moving. The number 800-222-9455, that's the toll-free, and live here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. So at any point here, you can give us a call. Eboo Patel, hello.
David, it's great to be with you.
Well, thanks for talking with us once again. We'd certainly appreciate it.
My pleasure. Now, you actually missed my my most important title, which is that I'm a University of Illinois graduate.
Well, I'm sure we would have gotten to that sooner or later. We would have gotten to that. You note in your book, certainly, as we know, that there are people whose religious faith seems to lead them to acts of violence. People who are willing to kill others and themselves in the process. So let me ask you what is probably the big central question here, and as you express it in the book, how does one ordinary young person's commitment to a religion turn into a suicide mission and another ordinary young person's commitment to that same faith become an organization devoted to pluralism? What really makes the difference?
You know, I think the answer to that question is actually very simple. I think what makes the difference is influences. Who influences young people? And right now, there are a set of very nefarious and well-organized people in the world who get to young people at a young age and shape their religious identities in the direction of heinous murder. And what we're trying to do here at the Interfaith Youth Corps is build an institution and a movement that is constantly messaging to young people and involving young people in religious identities and religious interactions that build pluralism. Mm-hmm.
Clearly, the possibility for pluralism rests on whether or not an individual lives in a society and in a community and perhaps in a family that's at least open to the possibility of pluralism. And it seems that there are plenty of places where that's not the case. What do you do? Perhaps this is an even more difficult question, but what do you do to try to promote pluralism if the community in which a person lives doesn't place any value on pluralism?
Well, I think there are multiple ways to understand the term community. And I think that it's very possible that there are local communities in various places of the world that reject pluralism. But there are two other ways to understand the term community, at least two other ways. And one is a historic way, which is to say that the Muslim community or the Christian community or America as a national community has existed over generations or centuries. And I think that in any historical view of a community, you will find wonderful examples of pluralism. So there's no doubt in my mind that there are some local communities in, for example, the Middle East that are Muslim communities, or in India that are Hindu communities, or in America that are Christian communities who currently reject any idea of pluralism. But if you go back in the history of Islam, you'll find the Fatimid Empire, which was a wonderfully pluralistic empire. You'll find the Abbasids. You'll find the Umayyads, which were, again, examples of pluralism within Muslim history. And you'll find the same, obviously, within Hindu history and within Christian history. So even if a particular community in a particular place and time rejects the notion of pluralism, I think somebody can always find in the historic tradition of that community examples of pluralism. And the second type of community we all live in right now is the global community, which is characterized in large part by mass communications. And, you know, you hear stories all the time of people who supposedly live within bubbles, people in Saudi Arabia or within China, where governments censor news and censor information, and they're still getting views from the outside. And so I think that there are multiple ways to reach young people all over the world. And one of the things that religious pluralists have to be much, much better at is using communications technology to articulate the vision of pluralism and to provide ways for those young people in all parts of the world to be part of building that dream of a common life together.
How important was religion in your home when you were growing up?
You know, I think that religion played something of an abstract role in my life growing up. And one of the things I say in this book was that the Muslim faith of my Indian immigrant parents in some ways got suffocated by another faith, which is the glittering idea of American achievement. And so we would, when I was a boy, we would pray together as a family in the morning and at night. And then as my father kind of climbed the corporate ladder and started going to work earlier and coming home later, we stopped doing that altogether. And it was always a very important thing in my family that the kids do very well in school. And a lot of things, including religious faith, was sacrificed for that. But there was one thing that was always important in my family, and that was serving others. And, you know, I remember a time when I wanted to drop out of the volunteer group at the local YMCA, and my parents wouldn't let me do it. And I said, you know, but it will improve my grades if I have extra time. And my parents said, you know, serving others is of utmost importance, and it's been a part of our faith tradition and our family tradition for generations. And that kind of struck me, because there had come a point in my family when we had stopped talking about religion, and it was amazing for me to hear, as a teenager, religion invoked in relationship with serving others. And I think that that's something that always stuck with me, even at the least religious points of my life, that the idea of religion and service were somehow deeply, deeply linked.
So it seems really clear that the environment that you grew up in, the family that you grew up in, was this interesting mix of respect for tradition, the fact that your roots were in India, that you were Muslims, combined with the fact that your parents really were, I hope it's okay to use a word like assimilated, they did see themselves as Americans. It seems that if you had some other kind of family, you wouldn't, I suppose that's true of everyone, you wouldn't be the person that you are or doing what you do.
Well, I think our lives are basically a jazz of the different experiences and influences that we have. And of course, everybody, like any great DJ or any great essayist, looks at the various influences and experiences and stitches them together in unique ways. And I think that that's what a life is about. But I'm enormously grateful to my family for the type of environment that I grew up in, and you know, really for introducing me to the notion that at the heart of Islam is serving others, and also recognizing that same fact in all other religions. You know, my best friends growing up were a South Indian Hindu, a Cuban Jew, a Nigerian evangelical, a Catholic, a Lutheran, and a Mormon from various Euro-American stock. And my parents loved them all, and they were interested in and were all in what all of their backgrounds said about who those young people should become and what they should aspire to. And of course, a young person absorbs that type of love and curiosity and appreciation from his family.
Our guest in this part of Focus 580 is Ibu Patel. He's the founder and executive director of the Interfaith Youth Corps. It's a Chicago-based international nonprofit building the interfaith youth movement. You can read about him in a recent memoir, Act of Faith, the story of an American Muslim, the struggle for the soul of a generation, was published earlier this summer by the Beacon Press. Questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. We have a caller from Bartlett to start out here with on our toll free line 4. Hello.
Good morning. Mm-hmm. How is everybody today?
Good.
Yeah, I like the way this gentleman talks about religion and his faith and what his dad is. He said it earlier. The you know talking to everybody and you know being friendly with everybody in different religions. The problem I see in this country anymore is there's no tolerance. You know, if you're Jewish and say some Christian decides he wants to put Christmas tree up, you can't do that unless you do a menorah. I mean, it's getting so out of hand, it's ridiculous. And, you know, I don't know, maybe it's me as a person. I can't see that. I want to say, can't we all just get along? You know, because what it comes down to is everybody has their God they want to pray to. You know, whether it be Muslim or Catholic or Jewish or whatever, we're all praying to one God, our God, and, you know, we shouldn't have to go back to the other guy and say, your God's wrong, because that's what it comes down to, and especially in the Middle East. Everything is tied into religion over there, and until this country understands how Middle Eastern people are, you know, we're always going to be at war with them. And, you know, I disagree with some of what Middle Eastern people, they use that religion is a crutch, but I also do respect their religion. And I do actually would like to, as a Lutheran, learn more about that religion and other religions. I respect everybody's different religion. I just wish that more of the country would do the same. I think if the world did this, we wouldn't have as much chaos as we do today.
You know, I think the caller makes some great points. Is this a good time to respond?
Yeah, sure. Yeah, do.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, thank you so much for calling. I think you make some great points. And let me just highlight some of those kind of one by one. Number one, I think that the caller is exactly right, that not only do we need more of what the caller calls tolerance in this country, what I call pluralism, but it's a central part of the American tradition. You know, if you go back in the writings of a Madison or a Franklin or a Jefferson or a Washington, what you will find is a very clear idea of the role of multiple religious communities in American public life. So Washington, you know, famously sends a letter to the Hebrew congregation in Rhode Island saying that America will brook no bigotry. And this is in the 18th century that he's saying to a small group of Jews in America at that time that they're not going to be discriminated against. And, you know, Ben Franklin famously says that the pulpit of a church that he is helping to build in Philadelphia should be open to a representative from the Muslim world preaching Islam, again, in the 18th century. So the idea of America as a place where different religious communities come together to make a nation with one another is embedded in this tradition, and I think we need to give that life. Let me just distinguish briefly between the term tolerance and pluralism. I think tolerance is a good thing, the idea that you look at somebody else and say, hey, you know, you go your way and I go mine. But I like the term pluralism better because in my mind, pluralism has three key components. The first is respect for identity. The second is relationships between people from different backgrounds. And the third is a commitment to the common good. I think what we're ultimately looking to build in Champaign-Urbana, in Chicago, in Illinois, in America, in the world, is societies in which people feel that their identities are respected and they can build relationships across lines of difference and they can have a commitment to the common good. And I think America has a decent record along those lines as far as nations go. But I think it can always be better. And I think that one of the ways to make it better is to have what we at the Interfaith Youth Corps call a different kind of conversation about religion. And you should come check out our website. It's ifyc.org. And learn about what it means to have a different kind of conversation about religion. What I mean by that is it's a conversation that highlights the values that different religions share while also honoring their particularities. And so you ask questions like, well, what does it mean to be compassionate in your religion? What are the scriptures or the poetry or the heroes that speak to that notion? What does it mean to do service in your religion? What does it mean to be engaged in justice? And then, you know, because practical, applicable work is at the center of what we do at the Interfaith Youth Corps, we actually organize projects in which young people actually apply those values of service and justice and compassion. And the University of Illinois has been a place that has organized some of our largest days of interfaith youth service over the past few years. And so I'm proud to be an alum, and I'm proud to still be involved in the university's interfaith work that's I think a model of religious pluralism for Champaign and for the state and for the nation and the world. Mm.
Certainly not all, but many religions teach that there is one truth, theirs, and that if you don't accept that, it may be, depending on their frame of mind, they might say, well, we'll pray for you, but you're lost. They might decide that converting you is more important than anything else. How do you, as a person of faith, think about that, the fact that many faiths do insist on that they have an exclusive grasp of the truth, and if you don't believe it, then you are lost?
Right. Well, I want to say multiple things on this, because I think that this is a question that a lot of people, particularly of liberal and progressive persuasions, of which I generally count myself one, get hung up on. They find this extremely troubling. So let me say, first of all, that every religion that I know of has multiple theologies, multiple interpretations of what scholars call exclusivism. So you will find Christians who are highly exclusive and say that one particular interpretation of Christianity is the only way to heaven, and you'll find Christians who say, listen, I find in the same tradition, in the same Bible, in the same gospel, that there are multiple ways, and I want to honor all of those ways, even as I might choose the Christian way. So I just want to say that there is literally no religion on earth that in which all the believers are only exclusivist. All religions have different interpretations and people who are walking different paths. But I also want to say that there are clearly many people in many religions who believe that their way is the right way or the true way or the best way or in some cases the only way to a good place after we die. And my response to that is, that's life. And I actually think it's just fine. That doesn't happen to be my interpretation of my faith, but I am kidding myself. I'm dreaming if I think that I am going to make everybody of the liberal theological persuasion in their faith. Moreover, I actually think that part of respecting somebody else's identity is respecting their right to choose to believe in God the way that they wish to. Now, I think that there is a stark line between a religious exclusivist and a religious totalitarian. which is to say you are perfectly welcome to think that your way is the only way or the best way to God. But you are not welcome to impose that upon me in a violent way or even in a way that marginalizes or suffocates me. And I think that actually you can have a lot of religious exclusivists who are also religious pluralists who say, listen, here is what I believe about heaven, but I also think that we need to work together to improve Earth. And so while I choose to pray for your soul in my church or my mosque or my temple, while we are together in the public square that is America, let's ask the question, not how can we convert one another, but how can we build this house together, or how can we plant this garden together, or how can we tutor this child together? I have to tell you, here at the Interfaith Youth Corps, we have a staff of 25, and many, many people on this staff are exclusivists. They think that their theology is the only or the best theology, and they're still working at an organization that is building global religious pluralism amongst young people because they understand that their theology is something that connects them with God, and while they may hope or pray for other people's conversion, they also realize that part of their relationship with the rest of the world has to be, how can we work together to improve Earth? Hmm.
Let's talk with someone else on a cell phone from Decatur. This is our line 4, toll-free line right here. Hello.
Hello. I think that your efforts is absolutely needed throughout the world, and I think that what you're doing here is extremely valuable. Hopefully, the ideas will spread, and this will become more encompassing. The only
God willing.
Trouble I have is that in the what I've read recently, that Muhammad, in his last statement in the Hadith, I think it is, that he makes a comment about jihad and that killing others or killing and then killing themselves in the name of the conversion of Muslim religion is okay. And if this is believed only by a small fraction of Muslims, which I probably assume it is, it is very troubling in the sense of the impact it could have. And I'd like to hear your comments. Thank you.
Sure. Well, I am not personally familiar with that particular hadith. I'll tell you what I understand, and from the Muslim tradition, and somebody who is relatively familiar with that in a somewhat scholarly way, what I understand the term jihad as meaning within Islam. Number one, jihad means struggle. And because the Muslim tradition had its birth during a time of physical struggle in the Arabian Peninsula, there are certain connotations of jihad which engage the idea of physical struggle against an enemy, particularly an enemy which is seeking to suffocate you, which is precisely the situation that Muhammad, may the peace and blessings of God be upon him, and his followers found themselves in during the early Muslim community. But as a famous story of the Prophet goes, as a group of Muslims were returning from a battle, and they were celebrating and speaking of their victory in jihad, Muhammad told them, "You have only won the lesser jihad. Now you must move on to the greater jihad, which is the struggle against your own worst self." And the vast majority of Muslims know that tradition and believe in that tradition, which is that at necessary times, it is true that there are parts of the Muslim tradition that say you have to defend yourself, and you have to defend yourself in a way that makes sure that your people are not wiped out. But that is a far less important struggle, a far more minor jihad than the one that we need to be engaged in all the time, which is the struggle to be a better person. And as I said, that is a story that Muslim children all over the world are taught at a very, very young age. And that's the central notion of jihad within Islam. So, you know...
Well, You know, I totally agree with what your interpretation of this. The thing I'm troubled about is the radical interpretation that does not see it in your view and is willing to sacrifice their life and even lives of other Muslims to... And I can almost empathize that some Arabs and some groups would feel that in the Mideast today that the United States might be having too much power and in endangering their existence to some way or another, or at least they could view it as that, or the potential for that. So,
right.
How do you
address
the radical portion of that is what I'm trying to say.
There's no doubt that there is a fringe element who calls themselves Muslim, who are radical and violent. And the truth is, they're much more dangerous to me than they are to you. Because the first people they go after are Muslims with a different interpretation of the tradition. Far more Muslims have died at the violent and murderous hands of Al-Qaeda than any other people on the planet. And so I am against them just as much, if not more, than you are. What troubles me is that just because those people call themselves Muslim and I call myself Muslim, that a lot of people lump us both together. I think what we have to do is make sure we get the idea of the faith line right. And the faith line does not separate just Muslims and just Christians, or just the Middle East and just America. The faith line separates people who I call pluralists and people I call totalitarians. So it sounds like the caller from Decatur and I are both pluralists. We might come from different religions, but we both believe in the vision of a society where people from different backgrounds are living together in equal dignity and mutual loyalty. And we both stand shoulder to shoulder against anybody who is a totalitarian, whether they're a Muslim totalitarian or a Jewish totalitarian or a Hindu totalitarian or a Christian totalitarian. And totalitarians are people who want only their group to dominate. And not Muslim totalitarians don't want Muslims to dominate. They want their small splinter group of crazy jihadis to dominate, and they want everybody else, including the Muslims who disagree with them, to suffocate. And the most important thing that we can get right in the world right now is who is on which side of the line. And I and the vast majority of Muslims are on the side of pluralism.
I think you have a very good point. I think this idea of pluralism that in the Muslim community has to be broadcast just a little bit more, because I think there's a lot of Americans that think that every Muslim isn't more to the radical than to the pluralist viewpoint. Thank you.
Right. We are a little bit past the midpoint here. I'd like to very quickly introduce again our guest, Eboo Patel. He's founder and executive director of the Interfaith Youth Corps. It's a Chicago-based international nonprofit organization interested in building the interfaith youth movement. He has a doctorate in the sociology of religion from Oxford University. He's a graduate of the University of Illinois, grew up in the Chicago area, a Muslim of Indian-American background. If you'd like to read more about him and his efforts to build pluralism, particularly concentrating on young people, you might look at a recent book that he has authored. It's Acts of Faith, The Story of an American Muslim, The Struggle for the Soul of a Generation. It's published by the Beacon Press, just came out in July, so I'm sure that you can find it in the bookstore. Questions are welcome, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Particularly now, over the last few years, as we've had the growing concern about terrorism, and we talk about the relationship between violence and religion, it seems that Muslims, particularly Muslims like you, end up somehow being responsible for what all other Muslims do. And people, I'm sure, say things like, well, what is it with you Muslims? And or at least for Muslims like you, why don't you go out there and fix those other people? I wonder, do you ever start, you know, how it is you feel about that? Or do you ever get tired of somehow being held responsible for what any other Muslim anyplace else in the world is doing?
Well, you know, it's kind of like this. It's kind of like you're watching the evening news and you see a guy who's 5'10" get convicted of armed robbery. And the next day on the bus, you poke the guy sitting next to you who looks about 5'10" in the ribs and say, hey, the heck is wrong with you people? I mean, that's about how much I have in common with these crazy, crazy Muslim murderers out there. So, I mean, on the one hand, I kind of laugh about it, and I'm like, well, you know, that's kind of a crazy notion. On the other hand, I actually think it's increasingly dangerous. I mean, we live in a world where people are writing bestsellers saying that all Muslims are susceptible to, you know, what a crackpot like Daniel Pipes calls sudden jihad syndrome, which says that, you know, the Muslim mom sitting next to you at the PTA meeting is going to whip out a machine gun and wipe the whole room out. And people are buying these books. I mean, Norman Podrach just wrote a crazy book called World War IV, The Fight Against Islamofascism, where he says that Al-Qaeda is a reasonably good window into mainstream Islam. And the last time I checked, a week or two ago, it was like number 10 on the Amazon bestseller list. And he's an advisor to a mayoral campaign, Rudy Giuliani's campaign. So, you know, we're watching the viral spread of an extremely poisonous discrimination that, number one, is, you know, as Mr. Podrach says in the title of his book, that discrimination is being used as an excuse and a pretext for all sorts of violent activity by our beloved nation state in the world. And number two, is being used to discriminate against normal, everyday Muslims. You know, I mean, I'm 31. I run an organization. I have a doctor from Oxford. I can take care of myself. But I have a five-month-old baby, and I think, you know, is he gonna be treated like a third-class citizen when he's in preschool because the preschool teacher has been reading only the violent stuff on Islam? I mean, are we basically quarantining an entire population of people in America by their faith? I mean, is that not the most un-American thing possible? So I don't particularly get tired of it because I feel like anytime somebody asks me a question like that, the answer is, number one, relatively obvious, that 1.2 billion people don't think the same way and, you know, don't believe terrorists when they try to teach you about religion. But I'm concerned about our political environment in this country, and I'm concerned about particularly young Muslims. And I'll tell you something, hatreds spread. And so there is an ugly rise of anti-Semitism in the world. And I think it's linked with the rise of Islamophobia. Once you start hating one group, once you get the attack helicopters out, they move from place to place. So I think that people who care about a pluralistic society need to be paying attention when one group, whether it's gays or Muslims or Jews or Latinos or immigrants, are being attacked.
Let's go on, and we'll talk with some more callers here. And the next up is in Charleston, line one. Hello.
Hi.
Mm-hmm.
That's just fascinating listening. I did want to know if you've heard of this particular perspective, because I haven't. It's just, I tend to be amazed at human arrogance on the whole. And I realized that I am a Christian, but I realized that in all likelihood, coming out of an Arab country and the like, Christ probably did not have light brown hair and blue eyes. And even though I'm Catholic, I'd be willing to concede he probably didn't look Italian. But beyond that, did you ever notice that when people try to draw close to God through most any religion, their lives reflect the same values, the choices they make? And those choices are not violent. And I always wonder, if I'm God, I mean, we're made in the image of God, then, despite all the times we try to make him in our image, who are we to tell him that if he sees somebody trying to draw close to him, who's trying to pray, trying to follow him and reach him through Christianity, through Mormonism, through Muhammad, through with the assistance of a rabbi, who says humans get to determine which prayers he listens to that are given sincerely and made from the heart? And I can't help but wonder if when the time comes that we won't be given some insight into each other as he can see into our hearts. And if we won't indeed be surprised that we really were all reaching him, I think we'd be delighted. Would you really react with, "I'm so disappointed, we weren't really the only ones"? I was wondering, am I really the only person who thinks that?
You know, I think that that's such a beautiful insight and a beautiful vision, and this idea that as we dig deeper into the roots of our own religious traditions, what we find is similar values. And I think that that's one of the reasons that so many of the great movements of the 20th century were interfaith movements. I mean, think about one of the great images of Selma, the March in Selma in the mid-1960s. It was the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. marching arm in arm with the Rabbi Abraham Joshua Heschel. And Heschel later says, "I felt like my legs were praying." You know, well, what is it that this Eastern European Jew has in common with this Black Baptist from the American South? You know what they have in common is the prophetic tradition of love and compassion and justice in their two religions. And if you think about the great movement to free South Africa, it was Muslims and Christians and Jews and Hindus working together to free that country. And I heard that from the mouth of Nelson Mandela in South Africa in 1999 at the Parliament of the World's Religions. And India was freed in large part by the efforts of a Hindu, Mahatma Gandhi, working together with a Muslim, Badshah Khan, on their shared value of liberation, equality, and freedom. So, again, this is what the entire premise of the Interfaith Youth Corps is, and what the entire premise of my book is, and it's the story of a young Muslim, me, coming to realize the importance of shared values in different religions, and then building an organization, the Interfaith Youth Corps, based on that notion. And again, your listeners can see more at ifyc.org. And you know, the big thing that we're doing at this organization is we're encouraging people to have a different kind of conversation about religion, and a conversation that leads to action that creates a different kind of world.
Well, again, I want to thank the caller very much for her comments and her thoughts, and go on, because we have about 10 minutes left and we have a couple of other people. So next, I'd like to talk with someone in Gibson City. This would be line number two.
Yes, hello.
Yes, hello.
First, I want to say thank you for what you're doing, and I really think you are really right on with the youth. That's where it's going to, you know, all not begin, but that's where I think it's going to take place in being an interfaith and loving one another and caring for one another. And I've had the opportunity to work in Israel-Palestine, and what they don't tell you is that there's Muslims and Jews and Christians working together for peace and nonviolence. And unfortunately, the minority violent group gets all the attention. And I've had some just wonderful, beautiful experiences with both Muslims and Israelis and, you know, the groups I work with. And that's where it's at, and like I said, unfortunately, there's the media and the world seems to concentrate on the violence. And I want to comment with the other lady, too. She's not alone in thinking what she's thinking. And there's a Hispanic pastor from our Mennonite faith in Chicago, and I went to one of his where he was speaking, and one thing he taught me, he says, "Let God be God." And I think that we as human beings, and I know I've failed in that too, is that trying to be God and deciding who's going to go to heaven and who's right and who's wrong. And I think we're going to be awfully surprised when we get to heaven who's going to be there. And I think that it's very important that we, as people of faith, whoever we are, to work together. And I'm looking forward to reading your book.
Well, thank you. I hope you enjoy it.
Yes.
Thank you for your beautiful comments.
Oh, well, thank you for what you're doing. And I'll hang up and listen. And again,
right.
Thank you.
Well, I don't know if there's any. We can go on to another caller, although if you had anything in the way of follow-up you want to say.
I want to just hone in for a moment on what that woman said about what is paid attention to in the media. And this is, you know, it's a fairly basic observation, but it's something that kind of hit me like a ton of bricks a few months ago. Why do Muslim terrorists in the hills of Pakistan or Afghanistan, or in the sands of the Middle East, why do they behead people and then videotape them? They do that because they want the world to see a particular movie on Islam. They send those videotapes to Fox News or CNN or BBC, and you know Fox and CNN and BBC and Al Jazeera play those videos. And effectively, that's Osama bin Laden's advertisement about what he thinks Islam is. And so the people who don't know anything about Islam and only see that video think, well, my gosh, every Muslim in the sands of the Middle East or in the hills of northern Pakistan is beheading people. That's not true. Muslims in the hills of Pakistan are herding goats. And right now they're fasting, and they're taking care of their families, and they're wondering about how to get their kids educated. And they're hoping that the transition in government that's about to take place is peaceful in Pakistan. In other words, they're a lot like us. And the reason that we don't think that is precisely because Muslim terrorists have a ridiculously effective media strategy. And part of that media strategy relies on the ignorance of people around the world about Islam, and it relies on their ability to communicate through spectacular and horrendously violent videos. And so, I mean, basically, I think that the lesson on this is simple. When a terrorist tries to teach you about religion, don't believe him.
All right, let's talk with someone next in Combine. This is line 3. Hello.
Hi, I'm enjoying the show. Well, my initial comment was it seems to me like a lot of people in the United States, anyway, that have a choice, kind of gravitate to whatever level in their religion that believes what they already believe. You know, there's people that seem to throw out half the Ten Commandments to go for some distant kind of a quote in the Bible that can be interpreted the way they already believe. And kind of to your last comment, I'm going to hang up, but kind of your last comment, sometimes it almost seems like the more violent and more it's my way or the highway parts of the religions almost seem to complement each other with, you know, your example of the Muslims. Some Muslims want an image of that, and then it seems to me like some Christians, well, that's a great advantage to them because, you know, it's easier to hate them or something. But
you know what, that's such a smart comment. I think that's exactly right. I mean, right now the dynamic in the world is you have a small group of Muslim terrorists saying Islam is violent, and then you have a small group of people who are not Muslims but who hate Islam and want it to be violent, and they're pointing at the Muslim terrorists and saying, see, bin Laden's right, Islam is violent. And you know those group, that group is called Islamophobes. And I think that the terrorists who call themselves Muslim and the Islamophobes who have this irrational hatred for Islam, they should all go into a room together and deal with each other and leave the rest of us alone.
Next, let's talk with someone in Charleston. This is line number 4, the toll free. Hello.
Yes, I hardly know where to begin, but history has taught me that religion is a tremendous, from the most ancient of times, a fraudulent process by which people are kept in upper childhood, cannot think for themselves, must have direction from this or that mullah or Christ or Buddha and all the rest of these heinous things that have been perpetrated onto humanity and perpetuated because people cannot, after enough lying, cheating, stealing, and all the other things that surround human discourse and social paradigms, have become, just as this man that you have on now has articulated, one of them is no better than the other. The Jesus given from King James, the prospect of the talent and the bushel, was that in vitro capitalism? I mean, when will we ever get past all this stuff? I'm convinced more so every day that we will not.
I appreciate what you're saying, and because I want to get a comment, and we're really getting short on time.
Okay.
So if you forgive me sort of jumping in. And Ibu, I really want to hear what you have to say, because it seems that now, recently at least, maybe at least within the last couple of years, I think we're hearing more and more people saying religion is irredeemable, that it has in fact been the source of great misery and suffering in the world, and that maybe we'd be better off if we didn't have organized religion.
Right. Well, you know, if you didn't have religion, you can write, you know, you wouldn't have a Gandhi, you wouldn't have a Dalai Lama, you wouldn't have a Thich Nhat Hanh, you wouldn't have a Desmond Tutu, you wouldn't have a Martin Luther King Jr., you wouldn't have a Jane Addams, you wouldn't have a Bhatia Khan, you wouldn't have, you know, on and on and on. And so, I mean, I understand the caller's frustration, because it seems like every time you turn on the television, you see people killing each other to the soundtrack of prayer, and then those people point to these ancient books called Scripture, and they say, see, this verse right there means that I have to kill you. And you know, all I have to say is just to quote Desmond Tutu, speaking at the recent Clinton Global Initiative, you know, religion is like a knife. If you use it to cut somebody's eye out, it's bad. If you use it to slice bread and give that bread away, it's good. And so the world is going to be religious forever. The question is religion going to be a force of pluralism? Is it going to be a force of service? Or is it going to be a force of totalitarianism and a force of murder? And I actually think that the people I call the aggressive atheists are hurting us more than they're helping us, because they're effectively saying that religion can only ever be a force of murder and totalitarianism. And that's just simply not true. I mean, it's empirically not true. Any cursory reading of history is going to show you multiple stories of religion. Any cursory conversation with a handful of religious people is going to show you that they each view their tradition and what it means in the world in different ways. So I think the big question is, how do we, whether you're a Muslim, a Christian, a Jew, or a non-believer, or a spiritualist or an agnostic, how do we collectively have a different kind of conversation about religion that highlights the shared values of different faiths, that is respectful, that seeks to build relationships, that seeks to be committed to the common good, and to move forward with that set of ideas and concepts? Mm. That's why, you know, at the Interfaith Youth Corps, we're not that involved in trying to convince non-believers to be believers. That's not important to us. What we're much more involved in is saying, how do we engage the fact of a very religiously diverse and in some cases religiously volatile world? How do we move it in the direction of shared values, respect, pluralism, and service? And for people who want to be involved in that constructive and practical process, you can go to ifyc.org.
We're very short on time. I'd like to try to get at least one more caller in. Mohammed, this is line one. Hello.
Hello. The previous caller brought up, and you extended the whole thing about atheists, let's just call it as it is, or agnostics, which I think is a very highly underestimated group in the world. And you did anticipate your idea of pluralism and everything to include possibly even atheists. But does your group actually reach out to atheists?
We have plenty of people who are agnostic or not particularly believers on our staff. And in fact, we have a conference coming up October 28th to the 30th where we have a session led by the humanist chaplain at Harvard. So, you know, we are bringing people together to engage positively and constructively in the issue of religious diversity. And
right.
A lot of the people involved are very religious. And have religious reasons for caring about matters of religious diversity. And I happen to be one of those people. But I think that anybody who is paying attention to our world is thinking to themselves, and anybody who is of good faith, although not necessarily of good religious faith, but anybody who's a well-meaning person is asking themselves the question, how can we nurture the fact of religious identity and religious diversity towards something that's positive and constructive? And that's what we do at the Interfaith Youth Corps.
And this is where maybe the atheists are selling themselves short without trying to put a faith label on it. I mean, being a recovering Catholic, it's a matter of faith that you believe that there is no God. And we are so disorganized that... throughout your conversation, it really was only at the end where the idea of the non-believers came into this play of.
Well, I think that non-believers have a lot of flags to fly right now. I mean, if I was a non-believer, this is about the best time in history to be a non-believer. There are a gazillion books and a gazillion conversation and a whole lot of claws that are being that are on the side of non-believers being poked at believers.
We're going to have to stop, and I apologize. We have a caller that we can't take. If you would like to read more about our guest, Eboo Patel, you can look for his book. It just came out earlier this summer, Acts of Faith, The Story of an American Muslim, The Struggle for the Soul of a Generation. That's the subtitle. It's published by the Beacon Press. He's the founder and executive director of the Interfaith Youth Corps. It's a Chicago-based international nonprofit organization working to build interfaith youth movement. And again, as he said, they do have a website. So if you'd like to find out more about the Interfaith Youth Corps, it's ifyc.org. You can go there and learn more about it. And of course, if you'd like to read his book, you can head out to the bookstore and look for it. Eboo, thanks very much for talking with us again.
Great to be with you. Thanks for having me back. And hello to all my friends at the University of Illinois and the broader Champaign-Urbana community.